Welcome to Talking Precision Medicine, the podcast in which we discuss the future of healthcare and health technology and how advances in data and data science are fueling the next industrial revolution. Our guest today is Dr. Ashley Zender, co-founder and CEO of Fauna Bio. Fauna is a revolutionary young biotech company using comparative genomics of an array of non-traditional mammalian models to discover new therapeutic opportunities for people. What do ground squirrels have to do with treating battlefield trauma? One way to find out. Come on in and have a listen.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us on Talking Precision Medicine. It is my distinct pleasure to invite Ashley Zender to join us today. Ashley is a co-founder of Fauna Bio. Fauna is absolutely one of my favorite young biotechs in the space because it is doing something so truly original, but I'm going to let Ashley tell you about it. So Ashley, welcome. And the first question is, can you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about Fauna Bio?
Yeah, of course. And thanks so much for having us on the podcast today. So yeah, as you mentioned, Fauna Bio is a company of a bit of a different flavor. My background is very relevant. So before starting Fauna Bio, I was a veterinarian and my background was more in exotic animal medicine. I did exotic animal residency at UC Davis and then came to Stanford to study cancer biology as a PhD, really with an eye toward understanding how different species get cancer or seem to be resistant to cancer and understanding the shared molecular mechanisms that exist across species. I was fortunate enough then to meet my co-founders during my postdoc at Stanford, both of whom worked on different aspects of genomics, and that becomes very relevant for the Fauna story. So both Katie and Linda have human genetics PhDs, but actually end up studying genomics from a very different lens. So Linda got very frustrated with how difficult it was to find really impactful human drug targets by using human data alone, and ended up pivoting her career into looking at comparative genomics, which is the study of genomes across species over perhaps hundreds of millions of years of evolution. That is work that has now blossomed into an effort called Zoonomia from the Broad, which was just published as an entire issue of Science, not just a couple of papers in Science, at the end of April, which we'll talk about more during the podcast, I'm sure. And then Katie, who's our CSO, also studied human genetics, but rotated in the lab of an investigator called Dr. Sandy Martin at UC Denver, who was studying hibernation genomics. So how hibernators use the same genes that you and I have, but in ways to help them survive really extreme environments. And Katie built some really precision, speaking about precision medicine, precision-timed samples from 13-line ground squirrels as a biobank of samples that we in-licensed to starting IP at Fauna. And so the three of us realized during our postdoc at Stanford that we had really three different legs of the stool that you would need to create this kind of company. It's really the focus on human genomics, but from a different lens, deep scientific insight into one particularly useful new model organism, the 13-line ground squirrel, and my background, which is more clinical translational coming from the veterinary side. And so what Fauna Bio seeks to do is understand how, again, the same genes that we have as humans are operating in species that have been adapted over hundreds of millions of years to survive extreme environments. And it turns out that we can use that as a lens to look at how these animals naturally reverse diseases and then more rapidly identify therapeutics to help humans live hopefully healthier and longer.
I think this is so cool. So the first thing I want to ask is just for clarification terms, what is an exotic animal vet? So what counts as like non-exotic versus exotic?
Yeah, it's funny because it depends a little bit on where you live. The definition of exotic animal is a little different in Florida than it is in California, as it turns out. But roughly, exotic animal vets tend to treat anything that people keep as pets that are not dogs and cats, at least from a companion animal standpoint. I have colleagues who do zoo animal medicine and then it's, you know, everything is fair game. But the exotic animal residencies will take into account birds, mammals, reptiles. Anything that's not dog or cat or farm animal tends to be considered exotic in the veterinary world. Yeah.
Got it. Yeah, I used to live in Texas and there were these stories of like this sort of oil wives who would collect like exotic cats, but like tigers. And then they would get banned and then they didn't know what to do with it. So I guess.
Yeah, there were the Skunk Owner Association in Florida that would probably get their skunks descented at the University of Florida where I went to vet school. So yeah, it depends on where you are in the country. You get to see some pretty exotic animals under that banner. For sure.
Wow. And what was your motivation for sort of going back to school, for getting into cancer biology and cancer research?
Yeah, it was interesting. I was finishing up a clinical residency and really intending to go into clinical practice, either as a professor at a veterinary school doing clinical translational research or out into practice. And this was around 2008, 2009. And as you might remember, the economy was not doing terribly well in 2008, 2009. And so a lot of the faculty jobs that I was considering had sort of disappeared. Veterinary school was not hiring in for new faculty. So I had a decision to make. I could decide whether to go out into private practice and sort of make a go of it or continue my academic pursuits and try to get a little bit deeper into the science. And so I had decided at that point to try to stay at UC Davis and do work in cancer biology specifically. I had been treating patients with all kinds of different forms of cancer with the oncology group at Davis. And we've been seeing that there were just differences in how tumors behaved across species. Certain species tended to get certain kinds of tumors and others didn't. We saw some species that we almost never saw with cancer. We almost never treated chinchillas with cancer compared to, say, rabbits who always had different kinds of cancer. So I really wanted to dig into that difference. And I noticed that there was a big disconnect in the clinicians who really understood how these diseases presented across different species and the biomedical researchers who understood the molecular mechanisms in those diseases. Often those researchers working more in the molecular mechanisms were looking at either human disease or usually just mouse and rodent models of cancers and not looking at how those cancers naturally presented across different species. And so there wasn't a lot of crosstalk there. The day I had to decide if I was staying at UC Davis to do a PhD, I got an email in my inbox from Stanford that said, "Are you a veterinarian? Do you want to do a PhD?" And I actually did. It was one of those very targeted spam emails, right, but not really spam. And so I looked into the cancer biology program at Stanford and applied there. And there was a program, it was a T32 program from the NIH to support, or NSF, I think, to support veterinarians who specifically wanted to do more biomedical research, and particularly outside of veterinary schools. It was really just Stanford and MIT that were having T32s that were not at vet schools. So it was a really unique opportunity to step out of that veterinary silo and work with people who were very focused on human medical research, but hadn't considered how, you know, the molecular mechanisms they studied worked in other species. So there were a handful of us vets that were pursuing PhDs in everything from basic biology to neurology to cancer biology, immunology at Stanford that had come from a clinical background and that were studying at Stanford. So I was the third vet who came in under that program.
Now, this is super cool. As I was mentioning before, my initial PhD thesis was looking at the proto TP53 gene in what we thought at the time was the earliest of all metazoan or multicellular animal. And I had no idea what I was going to do with it. It wasn't translational in nature, but I just thought it was cool because these things were colonial. They would divide by splitting in half. And so in principle, they had infinite lifespans, right? And you can't do that if you get cancer. You know, you have to maintain mitotic competence for your, you know, for forever. So I think this is super neat. But I'm interested now, and you know, you mentioned Katie and Linda, and they both kind of covered this from, you know, a different genomics lens. How did the sort of idea for fauna gel? Like, you know, what was the kind of crystallizing moment where the three of you realized, all right, let's take our knowledge here and our knowledge here and the ground squirrels there and do something with this?
So Linda and I had started collaborating as academics in the Bustamante lab at Stanford pretty much as soon as she had joined. It turned out she had always wanted to go to veterinary school, and I always wanted to work more in genomics. And so we immediately started working on collaborative projects. And we realized that there was really this huge untapped potential in comparative genomics because of just the sheer number of new high-quality genomes that were becoming available, enabled by a significant decrease in the cost of sequencing over time. What used to cost $1 billion and take, you know, 10, 15 years now was taking $10,000 and could be done in a matter of months for wholly new organisms, and enabling technologies like functional genomics. So RNA sequencing and proteomics were also decreasing really rapidly in cost. So there was just data now on hundreds of organisms that were potentially very directly relevant to human health. And the sort of larger biomedical complex, A, doesn't really know that this data is out there, and B, doesn't really know how to use it in the right way to get out the right kind of insights. But we did. And so we were starting to think about how do you build a company around comparative genomics and the advances in the technology there. That is a very broad company thesis. So it's a little bit hard to know where to start. Yeah. You cannot eat the whole apple at once, right? You have to figure out where to start. And we had started talking with Katie. We had seen the work that she was doing with the 13-line ground squirrel, and it's such an amazing organism. It was funny that neither Linda or I had worked in hibernation models. I came from an exotic animal background, but people don't keep hibernators as pets because they're kind of boring. They sleep half the year. So it's not something I had ever really worked on. And Linda, through all of her comparative genomics, hadn't spent that much time looking at the genomics of hibernation. So we really were learning from the ground up. But it is really one of these most remarkable mammalian adaptations, and it happens across every major group of mammals aside from marine mammals. Shouldn't do that for obvious reasons because they'll drown, and then hoofstock for whatever reason. But every other major group of mammals has hibernators, including primates. So there are lemurs in Madagascar who hibernate very similarly to 13-line ground squirrels. And so it's an interesting lens through which to study comparative genomics, because you can go back to really the core of the earliest mammals and look at pathways that have been conserved across these very diverse mammalian clades. And then you can start to look at really shared effects across mammals, including in primates and in humans. And you're starting to get to these core functional pathways in genomics through this lens of extreme biology and hibernation. And so talking more and more with Katie, we originally had talked with her almost more as an end user, right? If we were going to develop tools to accelerate comparative genomics, how would that help the field for folks like Katie who are working in specific models? And then we realized that a lot of the work that she was doing and understanding the genomics actually could be really useful for translation into human health. We kind of noodled on this idea for a few months in the Bustamante lab, and she was starting to think about doing an academic job hunt. I was just getting really frustrated with the potential lack of translation, right? The output of that academic work being largely grants and papers that say someday somebody will translate this into amazing advantages for humans.
Right.
And then a lot of times it doesn't go anywhere. And so she at some point was like, look, if you guys are going to start a company around this, I would love to join you. And with that, we have amazing, really deep expertise in a model organism that had decades of research behind it, really solid genomics, a biobank of samples that was rich and precise and larger than really anything we had in the world that we had really good trait mapping for that we could in-license as starting IP. So with that, we had a starting point, had an anchor. And so we really, right. Katie decided to join the company that we were able to crystallize what the idea would be and how to start mapping out what that translational path would look like, because we weren't starting from this vague domain of comparative genomics. We had a place to start.
So I have two questions, and I'm going to ask them in a specific order. Maybe we can go quickly on the first one and go deep on the second. The first one is, what is the signal you look for in a comparative genomics context that translates? So, you know, is it conservation? Is it conservation but, you know, some kinds of changes? And then the second one is, what therapeutic areas does hibernation as a phenotype point you towards?
Yeah, exactly. So we have optimized our platform convergence, which is named because it really converges animal and human data together, where we found a lot of traction and where we find a lot of impactful drug discoveries in the idea of looking at disease reversal signatures. So what makes hibernation, the questions I'm going to merge a little bit together.
Perfect.
What makes hibernation a really interesting model is that these are animals that through the course of hibernation, which is actually a much more dynamic process than most people realize. Most people think about hibernation as this process where animals kind of go to sleep and they just stay there for 6-7 months out of the year. That is roughly true in a species like a big bear that may only need to drop its body temperature by a couple of degrees to get the kind of metabolic savings that needs to survive without eating for 6-7 months. If you're a 100-gram ground squirrel with a much higher metabolism, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. And so these animals have to bring their body temperature down to almost freezing. So they'll hover at 4 degrees Celsius for 2 weeks at a time. Their heart rate will drop from 250 beats to 5 beats per minute. Wow. Their blood oxygen will go to about 10% of normal. Their metabolism drops to 1-3% of normal. So, I mean, really, they are in a state of suspended animation. They cease almost all brain function. So they're not sleeping. They're brain dead, essentially, except for two key brain areas, which I'll highlight in a minute. But they can't stay there for the whole period of time. It's not sustainable. So they'll stay in that period of suspended animation for about 2 weeks. But then they have to rapidly rewarm back up to kind of normal physiologic temperature. And they do that very rapidly over just about an hour. They'll go from almost frozen to normal body temperature, you know, 37 degrees Celsius, around 99 to 100 degrees Fahrenheit. And it's that rapid rewarming phase that can be quite damaging. It's a little bit like what happens during reperfusion injury in a heart attack or a stroke. So you have an organ that's been cold and hypoxic, and then you get this rush of warm oxygenated blood back into those tissues. You start to see evidence of damage. You see inflammation coming up. You see collagen coming up. So precursors to, say, scar tissue and fibrosis. Massive changes in the brain and how the brain connects, massive changes in tau phosphorylation in the brain. So this very dramatic change in what would be disease-causing in humans comes up as they're going to their about arousals, and then they're able to clear those every time they go back into torpor. And it's that clearing cycle that we find most interesting. So how do they turn off these genes that if they go on in humans become scar tissue fibrosis? How do they turn off inflammation How do they clear the tau that builds up in their brain when they're in torpor? And so the biobank that we have from Katie's work has 13 different time points along this very jagged hibernation cycle that allows us to very precisely map that turning off time point to a disease physiology. So we can look at, and again, sort of to your second question, we can look at pathways in fibrosis. We can look at a response to acute ischemic injury. We can look at changes in neuronal connectivity. We can look very closely at cellular metabolism. And that's partly why we've had such interest from a large pharma with an interest in obesity, like Novo Nordisk, trying to understand. They increased their metabolism 235-fold over that hour time course. So there's really nothing else in mammalian biology that you can look at that is that quite that extreme. And so, like I said, a lot of different metabolic phenotypes, response to hypoxia, responses to scarring and ischemia reperfusion injury, you could look at then at a sort of a tissue-by-tissue basis and understand how they start to be damaged, but how they turn it off. And it's those turning off time points that tend to map very nicely to the human disease genetics that we bring on the platform.
That's wild. So it occurs to me, though, there's more and more pressure on sort of neobiotechs to build sort of their own pipelines to a certain extent.
Yep.
So are you guys interested in also finding chemistry against novel targets, or do you look at yourself as kind of a target partnership company today? What does the Faunabio pipeline look like today and say 5 years from now?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. It's getting to novel chemical matter is really a crucial step for all biotechs, I think particularly these days. And so part of what the platform that we built does is it maps chemical matter to these genetic signatures. So we can map compounds that are existing to, let's see, if we just mine a gene signature of 20 to 30 genes that we know we need to either turn off or turn on to mimic this natural protection. We could map that to a library of small molecules. And then we have a rich set of medicinal chemistry resources in terms of consultants that we work with and CROs to then iterate and develop new chemical matter. So our lead program 1003 came out of understanding how these animals respond to low oxygen or hypoxia. We mapped those signatures to a library of small molecules. We found an older small molecule that we were able to use to then validate that it was protective in human cell models in our own labs here in Emeryville, but then also in animal models of disease with academic partners and CROs. And we saw that we were able to protect those animals from pulmonary fibrosis and the response to lung damage. And then we were able, now we have new chemical compounds that we've already derived that operate against the same target, but that are fauna owned. So yeah, that's part of the secret sauce at Fauna is really going from the genetic signatures rapidly to chemical matter and being able to derive new chemical. The target discovery part, we tend to reserve for large pharma who are interested in new strategies for large and complex diseases. So this is obesity. This is potentially areas like heart disease, chronic renal disease, where we hear from pharma that they have really all the human data that they want. A lot of the human biobanks are becoming fairly commoditized in terms of getting access to human genomics data and also mouse and rat data. They can generate all of the model data that they need, but it's getting them onto the same drugs and genes and pathways, right? They're not getting anything actually novel out of a lot of those approaches. At some point, you start to saturate what you can do. So they really want a new way to think about these really more difficult, complex disease areas. And that's where we can come in with our fauna-owned data sets else in the world has access to and start to build new target discovery programs with those pharma where they then pay upfronts and revenues and R&D support and then milestones for targets that come out of the fauna pipeline or discovery data. So we have have both of those business models. We build our own pipeline, but then we also partner with pharma where it makes sense. Yeah.
No, that absolutely seems like a game plan for sort of neobiotechs in this age. And congratulations, that's awesome to get that far. I'm interested, I mean, it sounds like, you know, the browse squirrel alone could take you into potentially dozens of therapeutic areas, but do you guys have ambitions to also expand on say, the, we'll call them non-model organisms or non-genetic model organisms anyway, to expand your data sets in that direction as well?
Yeah, we do. So we feel like the work we've done with the ground squirrel has really kind of broken the ice in terms of where people can start to look for this new strategy for therapeutics development. We have an internal cross-functional team. It's called the DREAM Team. It's Discovery, Research, and Emerging Animal Models. I didn't come up with the acronym. It naturally came out of the process. But it's their innovations team, and they work with academic labs who are developing models in other species where we can start to get in either tissue resources from those species, or we can help with sequencing, or we can help put together new genomes. So we have an entire separate Airtable and algorithm that we use to look at early stage partnering opportunities to bring in data from other species. So we've done that already with other hibernating mammals. So we work with an investigator at UNLV who works with Tenrex. We did a whole blog post on Tenrex and why they're awesome on the FaunaBio page, but they are...
What's a Tenrex? I'm sorry.
A Tenrex is, it looks very much like a hedgehog, but it's actually most closely related to African elephant. So they are Afrotherian. They live in Madagascar. And they have a very different mode of hibernation than the ground squirrels do. And they also have adapted specific ways to maintain cardiac stemness in their hearts at a much later stage of life so they can regenerate their hearts much later. So there's some different traits you can look at in those species versus the ground squirrels.
Uh-huh.
And so we have Tenrex hearts in the lab here in Emeryville, and we're helping to improve the Tenrex genome to the point where we can do the same kind of investigations that we could do with the ground squirrel. We are starting to look beyond hibernation. Hibernation's awesome in all the ways we've described, but it's not the only kind of disease resistance we see across the mammalian tree. We work with a group at the University of Florida that has built up a model in the spiny mouse. So these are African mice that can regenerate large portions of their skin without scarring, but it doesn't stop there. They have the ability to repair damage not only in their brain and spinal cord and kidney, also without scarring, which are obviously tissues that typically are not able to heal themselves without laying down scar tissue. So we have spiny mouse brain and skin samples in the lab that we're working with now to see if we can look at ways to impair brain healing and skin function through looking at the spiny mouse. So yes, we are looking beyond the ground squirrel. We're fairly selective in terms of the species we work with. There's quite a holistic criteria that we have to satisfy to want to get into new model organisms. But yes, this is really a tip of the iceberg in terms of looking at comparative genomics as a discovery strategy.
Very cool. So when I was in grad school and interested in comparative genomics, this was, you know, the early aughts, right? So the first human genome had just been published.
Yep.
And any new genome got you the cover of Science or Nature, right? It sounds like you're doing a lot of, you know, new genomes, or at least filling them out and filling them in. Why is this the time to be working on this kind of research? So, you know, why is finally the time for comparative genomics to make that translational leap arrive?
Yeah, and I'll make it clear that we are not doing a lot of the whole genome sequencing. We work very closely with the Zenobia group at the Broad. So Elder Carson, who is the head of vertebrate genomics at the Broad, is on our SAB, and she was the co-lead of this Zenobia effort that I mentioned kind of earlier on in the podcast. So I think we've hit this tipping point in terms of being able to get the kind of resolution we need on the human genome through the lens of comparative genomics. And Eleanor makes the point that if you're looking at understanding how highly conserved any particular base pair is in the human genome, if you just try to do that with humans, you really can't sequence enough humans to really get the resolution on that. You saturate after a certain point of time. But if you add on, you know, that first it was 29 Mammals Project, now it's Zenobia, now we've gotten to a point where a single base pair, we can tell you with very high confidence how conserved that base is across species. And that's important because conservation really does link to function. So if something has been highly conserved across species, it's much more likely that it's going to be functional. And you can start to do much more detailed and precise analyses on the importance of those base pairs and human disease. And so that's really the thrust of that Zenobia work. And so we've kind of hit that threshold now where we're at that single base pair level. Now it's really fine-tuning some of the trait mapping, like what species are really good at certain types of disease resistance, or what species have certain traits that may link to human diseases. Can we generate more RNA sequencing or proteomics from certain tissues? But on a whole genome level, we're pretty much getting to where we have enough of them to saturate that mammalian tree. And again, it's a story of rapid decrease in cost of sequencing, rapid availability of certain genomics data that have now hit this critical point where we can really understand the human genome at a much more granular level through this lens of evolution. But it took until, you know, that work was published just about 3 weeks ago, where all of that data has finally come together just to show that impact.
Yeah, I'm on the Zenobia website now, and it's cool because there's an illustration of a bat, sort of like the first thing, and a bunch of other cool animals. You know, and it occurs to me that most like major human pathogens, right, like the scourges of you know, human disease, have arisen from our close interaction with domesticated animals. And so it also, it seems to me that comparative genomics could be a real watershed moment for infectious disease as well as some of these other kind of human-specific disease traits.
Yeah, it's interesting. There is another group called Paratus Sciences. I'll put a plug in for them here too, because they're one of the other few companies using comparative genomics for drug discovery. They're focused on bats specifically, not so much infectious disease, but infectious disease from the angle of how do these animals resist the types of diseases that kill us quite rapidly. Mm-hmm. So things like Ebola and Marburg, and looking at how bats modulate their immune system, which I think is quite fascinating. So there are definitely folks that are looking at that response to infectious disease and other species. And I think that that bears some very nice fruit once they get the resources to do that. It's tricky to work with certain species. This is, I mentioned, the algorithm of species that we want to work with. It's tricky to get samples from some species. There are some of them are endangered. Some of them may carry a dangerous infectious disease, so you can't move them across country lines. And so some species, and there are definitely species of bat that fall in this category, you have to work with, say, iPSC-derived cells because you can't get the primary tissue samples. There are marine mammals that we would love to work with where you may only be able to get a skin or a muscle biopsy. You can't get anything else. So there is kind of this layer of tractability to deciding which models to work with. And we try to work with species in the near term where we can get access to the samples that we need. I think looking at infectious diseases across species is interesting for sure. Obviously, COVID brought that to light in stark contrast of just people paying attention to viruses that exist across humans and animals. But I think also looking at how those species respond to those diseases is going to be an interesting field for research as well.
Yeah, your description of the challenge of getting tissue reminds me, even in a disease area like cancer within humans, you know, where my company works, we have to be very thoughtful about which diseases we go after, because getting tissue from human patients can also be hard for different reasons, obviously, you know, deep biopsies and so forth. But I think this is a lesson maybe to folks who are thinking about starting a biotech, that you need to be very thoughtful about where you're going to get your source material and the impact on the organisms, human or otherwise, that you're trying to work with. It strikes me you mentioned two different hibernators from Madagascar. What is it about Madagascar that has hibernators?
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, both lemurs and tenrex come from Madagascar. I think Madagascar is an interesting kind of evolutionary hotspot anyway. Just every island tends to be. I don't think there's anything particularly unique about Madagascar in terms of hibernation, because we do find hibernators. I mean, the 39 ground squirrels live all throughout the United States and the Midwest. So I don't know that there's anything particularly interesting about Madagascar and hibernators, except that those two species are cool and they both come from Madagascar. But I'll ask Katie about that. I think that's coincidence.
Cool. Two data points. It doesn't make a line, but it struck me as in my complete naivete, it's like, doesn't get cold there. What are they doing hibernating in Madagascar? Maybe it does get cold.
Yeah. And I think there are some mountainous regions where it gets chilly, and they do these kind of daily torpor bouts that look as very similar to what happens in the ground squirrel. They're not taking their body temperature down to freezing, for sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the ten rex all tend to hibernate in these big collective burrows for longer periods of time.
With the super rapid changes in physiology, it seems like there has to be some sort of epigenetic component to that. Do you guys also get into other omes besides just the base genome? I mean, you said mentioned gene signature, so I presume there's RNA involved, but...
Yeah, we look a lot at RNA sequencing. We do look at some epigenetics as well. So we do ataxic on a certain number of tissues and see, like, what are the chromatin regions that are open and accessible at these key time points? Does that map to the expression changes that we're seeing? We have some proteomics data. It's not as rich as the RNA sequencing data. We're looking to improve the proteomics and the metabolomics data that we have on some of the biobanks, as some of the work that we're doing with some of the big pharma that I mentioned. Some of that involves generating these additional data sets. So yes, ideally we layer on multiple different kinds of omics data because we really want to see the whole picture of how these genes are changing. Part of what Katie worked on during her PhD was looking at mechanisms of protein stability. So what happens in a lot of times is that these protein transcripts are really just held stable and sort of waiting for the environment and the overall animal condition to be conducive to being able to then translate and make those proteins active. RNA is held stable, and then they can rapidly translate it into protein. So there's a lot of interesting mechanisms around just protein stability, protein degradation, RNA stability, RNA degradation. That means you don't have to start from scratch. Because if you're, again, going to use these things within an hour, you don't have the time to make them from scratch. So you have to kind of have them ready and available. And that's been interesting to look at shared mechanisms with humans in pathways relating to RNA stability, degradation, protein stability. And we have some programs that the genes we identified are really core to those functions. That makes makes sense from a physiological standpoint.
No, that's super cool. I'm picturing like a cartoon of figure 7 in a paper where you have all the molecules you need. They're kind of held in ice cubes. And all you need to do is turn the heat up enough to let them all enter.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's super cool.
Something like that.
I want to switch gears a little bit and talk a bit about building companies. So you three founders, yourself and Kitty and Linda, are all scientists and doctors. What's it been like building a company? How did sort of the desire to do something, you know, entrepreneurial come about? And what's been your experience, broadly speaking, in company building?
Yeah, I mean, we all came to Fauna from a place of, I think, frustration and seeing that there was an opportunity to start to work with the state in a way that would really start to make an impact on human health. But seeing that there was a very high, very unlikely that anybody else would take this and run with it. So it very much felt like if we don't do it, nobody else will kind of situation. We were fortunate to meet Laura Deming very early in that process and go through Laura's Age One Accelerator, which the purpose of that accelerator was to take scientific founders and help them build companies rapidly, right? So in terms of just how do you structure the company? Who do you bring on your SAB? How do you start to think about hiring your first employees? How do you build up that first product roadmap? How do you start to translate the science that you are working on into materials that the general audience and also investors can wrap their heads around? And so Laura and her team, operations team at Age One, were very helpful in just that initial process. And then it's really been bringing on board people who have experience doing drug discovery. So we brought on about 2 years ago now, Brian Berkey, who was at Novartis for a little over 20 years doing early stage drug development, and then worked on more clinical stage programs with smaller startups, one of which was a spin out from Novartis and was a different startup, working primarily in cardiometabolic disease, but having worked on approved drug programs, you know, that eventually went all the way, which is great. He's worked on two of those. And so having him come into the company, look at everything that Fauna was doing and say, look, you know, this is worth your time. This is not worth your time. This really has legs under it. This doesn't. And really pick those winners and prioritize them for development and then take over the development strategy for those assets has been really game changing for us. He worked with Tom Hughes at Novartis. Tom Hughes has been in our SAB almost from the beginning. So he was also at Novartis and is now CEO of a company called Navitor, which works on mTOR signaling, not surprisingly. And so between Tom and Brian, just getting the feedback on, you know, how do you build off a drug pipeline? How do you start to think about partnering? Navitor's done partnering with pharma as well. And bringing folks onto our board. So we have a board observer who has done a lot of work with smaller companies and partnering, particularly from the genomics side, genomics platforms, and how do you start to get value out of those pharma partnerships? So I think it's bringing on the right people and helping you figure out how to prioritize the work that you do and make sure that you're building things that are commercially viable and tractable and building value over time.
And in terms of building, you know, Fauna, the company, not so much the business, do you and your co-founders have, you know, kind of guiding principles? You know, what is the kind of workplace you're trying to build for you and your team?
Yeah, we've been really intentional about culture, even when we were still a team of five, right? We were a team of five or six for the first couple of years through the pandemic until we now work to 17. But even when we were a small team, we would take company retreats and really think intentionally about the culture. It was really gratifying to see that those messages ripple from those times we did our retreats in 2019 to when we onboarded, you know, so we almost tripled in size by the end of 2021, and then do that same kind of messaging exercise and see those same themes come through, which were dedication to good science, focus on work that is impactful to humans at the end of the day, right? We want to work on high impact work and building a culture of collaboration, like really working with team members to get things done. And that's the theme of what the people that have come to Fauna really want to do. You know, if you want to be a rock star in academia, that's fine. If you want to actually work with a team and make an impact, then that's when you transition into a company like Fauna. And so the team itself has been, from the ground up, very interdisciplinary. Like I said, I mentioned the dream team earlier is interdisciplinary, but that's one example. We have several other kind of ad hoc teams that work across computational, therapeutics, wet lab, to get projects done, and they pull from all the resources at Fauna with the goal of just bringing the best team together to get the work done as possible. So that's something we've been very mindful about cultivating through, even though when we were very small. And I think that's been really helpful.
That really resonates. I think, you know, making a point of defining your culture and infusing it through everything. You know, then they say that, you know, you really want to be selective when you're hiring, right? You want to select your culture. But I find that if you lead with that, it becomes self-selecting and it makes your job a lot easier.
Yeah, people do come to us, right? We have people who we've hired who come almost out of the woodwork and said, hey, I didn't know there was a company like this, but this is the only company I could ever imagine working for. Do you have a job opening? And we have, you know, where it's a good fit, have found jobs for those people and they've been rock stars. So when you build a really unique company that's dedicated to this really unique mission, people find you. They want to come work for you.
So I'm curious, we can kind of almost treat this like a lightning round, although there's no real time limit.
Sure.
What's been sort of the surprisingly hard stuff to do building a company or this kind of company? And the flip side of that's, you know, what's worked really well, or maybe what's been sort of pleasant surprise, like, holy crap, that went.
I think we've been pleasantly surprised at how well we've been able to translate findings from the Search and Line Ground School we started with into novel genes and compounds in multiple broad disease areas. Obviously, we hoped it was going to work when we started the company, but it's really gratifying. Right, obviously, we would have done it. But it's been really gratifying to see that we can find genes and compounds that improve response to ischemia reperfusion or low oxygen, reduce fibrosis, change tau phosphorylation in our human neuronal models, reduce inflammation in our human GI models. So very broad, different disease areas. Once we model them in human cells in the lab, we see these really profound effects by lifting over just from this first model organism that we started working with. And so now we have a very good feeling for, okay, we know, you know, roughly how many hits we'll get when we screen how many genes and compounds. And it's been fairly consistent actually across different disease areas. And I think we were pleasantly surprised by how well that has done. I think that's kudos to both Katie and Linda in terms of being able to build a platform that rapidly identifies genes and compounds that translate rapidly, and to Katie for the science that she had in terms of building this really strong biobank with such precision data, that the data that we get out is really clean, and that's really helpful. What's been harder, I think, is just getting over the naturally ingrained biases of biotech writ large that is very focused on human data and sort of having this narrative of, yes, we know that you're really focused on human data, but what Fauna is really doing is trying to use all this evolutionary genomics to actually show you what's most important in the human genome, right? Is really, you know, we love 39 ground squirrels, don't get me wrong, but like, I don't need to cure disease in 39 ground squirrels, right? We're using the data from these species to just shine a spotlight on what's most important in the human genome. And that is a message it takes a little while for people to understand. You have to kind of beat that horse for a while. Also, you have pushback from folks who have maybe spent a lot of their careers either working in human genomics and are frustrated with genomics as a discovery data set. And we would argue that that's because you need these other data to really understand that. Or they've been burned, as we all have, who have done bench research on translating data from mouse and rat models back into human disease. And so then they put a black mark on anything that is seen as discovery animal models. And we have to then do some re-education of, well, that is because what you're doing is trying to take a mouse or rat, break it in some way to look like a human disease, either genetically or chemically, try to fix that in that model, and then back translate it to humans. And it, if you think of it in that context, it's not that surprising that it doesn't work all that often. So what we're trying to do is say, let's just look at how those genes function in the natural evolutionary context, look at where there's natural overlap in human disease genetics, and then go directly into human disease models. And so it's really thinking about animal models in the completely opposite way to how people are used to thinking about them. And that takes a bit of an educational hurdle to get people over. And people either intuitively are like, oh my God, this is amazing, why aren't we doing it this way? Or they just don't really get it. There's no rule in between on Fauna. You either love it or you don't. And we just try to work with the people who get it. Just the other people will figure out eventually.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I'd be interested to understand what your experience has been with investors, because, you know, every VC I've ever met likes to at least beat the drum that they're contrarian thinkers, right? They're looking for the next contrarian idea. But but I find that that's actually typically not actually true. And what you're describing to me is genuinely contrarian, right? Like, you've got truly unique data that no one else has got, no one else would even think to have, and a very different approach. Have you found well, obviously some folks have been receptive because you've got some funding, but is it a lot of head scratching, or does this take extra explanation still?
Again, investors, like most folks we talk to, either fall into the like, oh my God, I've never heard this before, but I love it, or I've never heard this before, this is weird. The people that have really latched onto Fauna and have been really strong supporters are those investors who are used to investing in really frontier edge technology, where they're used to working with companies that are maybe doing something that nobody else has ever done before, and they're okay with that. And really looking for, why is this team the right one to build this company? And we obviously like nail that one squarely on the head, right? I mean, it's hard to think of three people who could build this company other than the three of us, really. And then it's been bringing the rest of them along for the ride and really just building that mountain of evidence to show that it's working, right? Showing what works in one disease and multiple diseases with all the human genetics, with the pharma partnerships. and just stacking those levels of evidence on top of one another. And then you just kind of keep going back to the investors and say, you know, that thing I told you was going to work, look, it worked. Right. And then here's what we're doing now. And so at some point, at the end of the day, like every startup, it becomes about execution. And so that's kind of where we are now, is just executing on what we said we were going to do. And people appreciate that and are paying more attention for sure.
On that, let me just ask you, do you have any sort of visions of the future, like 5-10 years out? Do you think that this approach will have caught on more? I mean, where is Fauna Bio going to be? Obviously at the forefront of the comparative genomics and therapy field. But, you know, what are your parting thoughts for the audience on what to look for in this space?
Yeah, I think it's a really, really amazing time to be doing work in this space. Like I said, we're not now not the only company doing it. There is at least another one named Paratus who has funding from some very high quality biotech investors to look at bat biology, which I think is super, super cool. There are smaller companies that are working in particular other models and doing asset development based in axolotls and other species, which I think is really interesting. So it feels very much to me, and I make this analogy because we were in an aging accelerator and we work a lot with kind of aging related biotech. To me, it feels a lot like where the aging longevity field was maybe even just 5 years ago, where it was this kind of drumbeat that there is something here, but it needs to grow. We're hearing those drumbeats now, I think, with comparative genomics, where, again, the data is available. Companies are starting to translate it. People are seeing the applications for diseases that really haven't had innovation on the human side in decades. And it's going to take this preponderance of evidence to build, but it's getting there. So I would hope that, similar to what we see in longevity in the next 5 or 10 years, that Fauna and Paratus are not the only companies in the space doing it on a broad discovery level, that there are more of us. And we look forward to seeing the field growing over time. We certainly will be a clinical company by then with multiple pipeline assets in the clinic and multiple pharma deals kind of bearing that out. But yeah, it's definitely a space to watch. It's just at the beginning.
You know, that's fantastic. And I'm definitely in the love it camp. Comparative genomics, you know, has come a huge distance in 20 years or more since genomics became a real thing.
For sure.
And this is great to see. Ashley, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for blazing this trail for those of us who really love this stuff. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, no, thanks for letting me chat about Fauna. I will always do that whenever anybody asks me to. So.
This has been Talking Precision Medicine. Please subscribe to the show, share this episode with your colleagues, leave a comment or review, and stay in touch for the next one. More information, visit genialis.com or follow Genialis on LinkedIn. Thanks for joining the conversation.